Welcome to Ask the Experts, a monthly podcast taking on the latest questions around healthcare legislation and compliance.
Welcome to today's episode of Ask the Experts. With us today is Shelley Bloom, Director of Legislative Awareness and Training. Before we begin today's podcast, I would like to read the following disclaimer. This podcast is designed to highlight various employee benefit matters of general interest to our listeners. It is not intended to interpret laws or regulations or to address specific client situations. You should not act or rely on any information contained herein without seeking the advice of an attorney or a tax professional. When do young adults become eligible for the subsidies on the marketplace or exchange instead of staying on the parents' plan?
Well, Jim, that's a question that depends on the person's tax situation. So as we know with the Affordable Care Act, when an employer offers coverage, they also offer coverage for dependents up to the age of 26. The employer doesn't have to contribute anything toward the cost for the dependent. They simply have to offer the coverage. And we also know that with the ACA that the person can be married, can be living in a different city, in a different state. They can have kids. So really, as long as they qualify to be a dependent of the parent, they can stay on the plan. However, when you go to the exchange or the marketplace, they look at things in a slightly different way. They're going to look at the income of the family. In this case, the dependent, the child, whatever you want to call them, let's say it's a 19-year-old person that is looking to be on their own and possibly to get the subsidy. In this case, they're going to ask if there's coverage that is offered by the employer, and in some cases that answer would be yes. But they'll also ask about the income of the family. So if that 19-year-old can be a dependent on his mom or dad's tax return, then that may prohibit him from getting a subsidy. If he's out on his own, living in his own apartment, filing his own tax return, then they're going to look at his income in a different way. So it's very situational, and it truly depends on the dependent, him or herself, where they're living, and what is happening with the household or the way that that person files their taxes.
Now, Shelley, for question number two, can mini COBRA or state continuation be extended?
That's a quick answer, and it's a no. Whatever the state offering is, in Pennsylvania it's 9 months, in New Jersey it's 18 months, in New York it could be as long as 36 months. When the qualified beneficiary has reached that maximum limit, that's it. They're ending. So whether it's 9, 18, 36, or something else in some other state, that's it.
The CORI fees are due July 31st for plans. Does a level-funded plan have to pay the fee? What if the plan also offers an HRA?
Thank you for that question. And yes, PCORI rates are due the second quarter of every year. So July 31st is the date, actually August 1st, because July 31st is a Sunday. But a level-funded plan, it looks like they're paying a premium every month as though they're fully insured, but they truly are self-funded, level-funded, and yes, they need to pay the fee. The fee would be paid on each person that is enrolled in the plan. You're looking at the average of the months that the plan was in force, and from the PCORI perspective, you're paying the fee based on the month in which your plan ended. So if you were a January through December, your plan is ending December of 2021, so you're going to pay the fee based on that. If you renewed July of 2020 and you end June 30th, 2021, you're going to pay a slightly different fee based on that. About the HRA, so if a level-funded plan also has a health reimbursement arrangement that is attached, the level-funded plan is paying for the participants that are in the health plan. They do not need to pay another fee for the HRA that is offered. If we have a fully insured plan and that fully insured carrier is going to pay the PCORI on the behalf of the employer. But if the employer also offers that health reimbursement arrangement, that HRA, in this case, the employer is going to pay the fee only for the HRA, and they will pay only for each of their employees that is eligible for the HRA reimbursements.
If John Doe is the employee and Mary is his spouse, both were covered under the employer's health plan. John takes a job outside of the U.S. that offers him benefits. Mary is staying in the U.S. Does she have an offer of COBRA from John's prior employer?
The answer to this would be yes. And the key to this is who was on the plan for that employer that is giving the offer of COBRA. You stated earlier that John and Mary, John's the employee, Mary is his spouse, both of them are on the employer's plan. Then John left this job to go to another job. So both John and Mary would be eligible for COBRA benefits and eligible individually. In other words, even though John and Mary were covered as a couple, John now has moved overseas for a period of time and is on the benefit plan specific to that foreign country. Mary's staying here in the United States. Mary has the opportunity for COBRA. Let's assume in this case it is federal COBRA. So she would be able to enroll in the federal COBRA plan offered by John's former employer, and she would pay the single rate because she is the only one that needs to enroll in the COBRA for that time frame.
Now, Shelley, for question number 5, the employer is an ALE, an applicable large employer. An employee has been full-time and enrolled in the benefits. The employee reduces to part-time. Because of the ACA stability period rules, the employer must continue to offer benefits to this employee. How is affordability affected?
This is always one that seems to trip people up for as long as we've been doing these ACA plans, 2014 for some, 2015 for others. But when you have an employee that is eligible for benefits, the affordability amount is calculated usually at the time of renewal. So when you're renewing, you tell everybody, here's what our lowest cost plan is. Here's what you need to pay if you want to be enrolled in that plan. And as long as the employer doesn't make any changes to that over the course of the year, and also if the employee does not have a reduction in their salary or their hourly amount, depending on how they were being paid, then you're still going to use that same renewal date and the amount that was offered then. So even if this employee goes from full-time to part-time, but in being offered part-time still has to get the offer of benefits, you're going to refer back to when the affordability was originally calculated, and that coverage would still be affordable if that person now going part-time wants to continue to pay the amount to stay on the plan.
Form 5500 filings are due July 31st for employer groups that have a January renewal date. Can you remind us who this applies to?
Yes, Form 5500 filing is coming up July 31st. So generally, this applies to employer groups that have 100 or more people enrolled in any one of their plans. It could be health insurance, it could be life, it could be dental or vision. So if you have 100 or more people, you need to file that Form 5500. There are other employers that may need to do that filing. There has been some question lately about small employers that are doing level funding or self-funding. Do they need to fill out that Form 5500? So yes, they are a small employer, but you'll have to work with your own counsel or your CPA to ask more specific questions, because it does depend on how you set up your plan and how the payments are made. So usually a smaller employer under 100 enrolled does not have to, but there are different circumstances based on each employer. So I would certainly advise that smaller employer to have a conversation with their CPA and or their counsel to find out for certain, do they have to file or not?
Shelley, can an employer change their contribution requirements from the employee mid-year?
The answer to that is yes, they can, but there are, certainly are some things that the employer needs to consider before they do that. So they have their renewal and they told their employees, here's the amount that you need to contribute. Oftentimes there are some difficulties with the employer, and so they need to change the contribution schedule, potentially asking for more of the employer. So they need to give them 60 days notice. That would be the best way to let the employee know ahead of time. They also would likely have to speak with their administrator for their premium-only plan, also known as their POP plan, or their Section 125 plan, because likely that the employees are contributing on a pre-tax basis the amount that they are being required to contribute to pay for their benefits in full. So those are the minimum things that the employer would need to do in order to make that switch in the contributions.
An employer wants to offer cash to employees instead of enrolling in their health insurance benefit. What are the concerns for the employer?
So this depends on the size of the employer. With the Affordable Care Act, we know that small employers, and we're talking here about small employers using the federal definition, that would be an employer with fewer than 50 employees. They are not required to offer a plan. If they do, that plan does not need to meet the affordability test. They can determine whatever hours they want to be full-time, and contributions can be whatever they want. If we're talking about an ALE, an applicable large employer, with 50 or more full-time and full-time equivalent employees, then the rules are different, because now we have to consider that that ALE, applicable large employer, offers a plan that is minimum essential coverage, minimum value, but most importantly, affordable. So the affordability test is what is a concern here. So if an employer says, I am going to offer cash to anybody who does not want to enroll in my plan and they want to take the cash, first of all, the ACA says that that employer needs to get proof from that employee that there is coverage somewhere else. Then they would, in most cases, be able to pay out that cash in lieu of taking the benefits. Here's the trigger for the employer. If the employer does not get that proof of coverage for that employee, but they pay out the amount anyway, then that amount that they are paying in lieu of benefits actually gets added to the amount that they would be required to contribute for the lowest cost affordable plan that that employer is offered. So you can see that it's adding an additional amount, and in most cases that is going to make that plan for that particular employee not affordable. So just a caution to any employer who wants to do that. There are some things that they need to follow that makes it maybe a little bit more difficult from an administrative perspective.
Now, Shelley, for our last question, can you talk about the most recent requirements related to transparency, mainly the machine-readable files? The due date is July 1st, 2022, and many questions have come up about who needs to file, what they need to post, etc.
Yes, Jim, this is the big open-ended question here. I'm glad you saved it till the end. We've had a couple of our Tuesday calls, which have become the Thursday compliance information that we share with a lot of our employer groups to explain this. But basically, it's an ongoing opportunity for employers, hospitals, carriers to participate more fully in transparency. The Department of Labor, the HHS, Health and Human Services, and the IRS together said we need to have more transparency in healthcare. So there's been requirements for the hospitals. There has been broker transparency. Now these machine-readable files is taking the top 500 services that that were decided by those three agencies, and every carrier has to list what the reimbursement is, both in-network and out-of-network. This applies to all size groups, whether you are level funded, fully insured, self-funded. All employer groups need to do this. If you're fully insured, you're going to look to your insurance carrier to prepare and post these files for the fully insured employer. If you are self-funded, then you're likely going to work with your third-party administrator and probably the person or persons that are providing your network for you to help to create this. It is enforceable starting July 1, so that means the carriers need to have these machine-readable files available starting July 1, the same as the self-funded employer groups. These files are required to be updated monthly, so it's not like you just post this once and it's done. They will be public-facing files, so when an insurance carrier posts that, everyone will be able to see that file. So from the self-funded side, if you are creating this with the help of your third-party administrator, you should be posting it so that the public can see it as well. So for everyone, July 1st is the date, and then those updates must happen on a monthly basis. The employer can choose to post those publicly, whether they're fully insured. If they want to take that file from the carrier and do that, they can. That's completely up to them and working with their IT administrator to see if it's possible for them to do that. We've issued some bulletins on this, and like I said, those Compliance Thursday recordings that we send out will be very helpful to review as well.
Everyone, thank you for listening. Please join us next month for another edition of Ask the Experts.